Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Jane Crown Show. Today, my guest is someone that I've been waiting for several months to get on air. He's someone that I have published in my magazine, Heavy Bear. He has some wonderful poems that he's going to be reading from you today from several different chapbooks. The primary one that we're going to be talking from today and he'll be reading from to be five poems is called The Warrior Poems. My guest is Scott T. Starbuck. This book is out with Pudding House Chapbook Series, and I'm going to go ahead and read you guys the rest of the bio so you get an idea where you can find him, that kind of thing. His other recent political poems essayed have appeared and are forthcoming in Rune at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Heavy Bear, Drunken Boat, Fogged Clarity, which are audio poems, and I'm going to let you guys know you can use an actual machine to search these things. Google's real good. I'm not going to give you the whole address, but you can always check it out in the archive after the fact if you get confused. Let's see. The November 3rd Club, the Trumpeter Journal of Ecosophy at Athabasca University, Blood Orange Review. Let's see. Terrain.org, Talking River Review, the Foster's Collective Visual Response to Gulf Oil Disaster at the Landslide Gallery in Chicago. The Poets for Living Waters website, Vibrant Gray, Hubbub, The Oregonian, The Oregon English Journal, The San Pedro Review, and The Dog Singing Anthology at Salmon Poetry in Ireland. F.J. Bergman, poetry editor of Mobius, a journal of science and change, nominated his initiation poem for the best 2010 poem on the net. Let's see. Christine Klonick Lim, editor of Autumn Sky Poetry, nominated his poem The Last Wild Otter Near Otter Crest, Oregon, 1906, for Best of the Net 2009. These days he spends a lot of time alone in wilderness areas, which is where he met Warrior, the inspiration for his recently published chapbook, The Warrior Poems. The back cover notes, Warrior is a muse who visits Pacific Northwest rivers. The chapbook is one of six finalists of over 500 entries at the 2009 Pudding House Chapbook Contest, featuring protest poems about human rights, animal rights, media distortion, Iraq war, sour economy, and the G.W. Bush presidency. It is available at jen@puddinghouse.com, and his newest chapbook that's about to come out is of nature poems. It's called Riverwalker, and it's forthcoming from Mountains and River Press in Oregon. Welcome to the program today, Scott.
I'd like to use a video in my classes called Is She the Last Yahi, which is a really great video about the Yahi tribe, which lived in Northern California for about 2,000 years and were hunted by ranchers in the early 1900s. And the state of California would reimburse the ranchers 25 cents for a scalp or $5 for a head for a Native American. They were hunted like deer. So wow. I just think it's really important people know that history. Who will compensate for the slow plastic deaths of 70,000 marine mammals off San Francisco? For millions of Vietnamese sacrificed so defense contractors can live in Bird Rock and vacation in Italy. For 2,000 years of issues, people eradicated at 25 cents and $5 a scalp. For extinction of Rose Creek steelhead trout so their spawning reds could be a storm drain. People forget the Golden State's gold was produced with arsenic. Offshore, there is a howling, eerie, and striking in the eyes of another cancerous fish. When I taught at Laramie County Community College in Cheyenne, Wyoming, I had students that worked at the missile silos,
sure.
And so this poem was influenced by that experience. My country with quotes. During the Iraq War, I wondered why our bombs were called smart and the enemy's scuds. What happened to uranium tip missiles and how much collateral damage was too much? Later, I wanted commentators to detail the failure of imagination in the 9/11 report, to define exactly what it meant to win or lose this war, to show how waterboarding was not torture. I wanted elite professors to summarize Black Belt Speaks for a non-native audience, to explain the Ute legend of the sleeping dragon at NORAD, to say in the vast Wyoming plains what Minutemen dream in their dark silos. So there is a serious political issue that comes up. I try to take it head on. In my critical thinking classes, I use a video clip from Chinua Achebe, and he said that writers have different agendas than emperors, you know, that the I think it was implied that the agenda of a writer is to try to tell the truth. Sure. And we know the emperors sometimes don't do that.
Indeed.
And so it's been a lot of fun to do that. Also, I feel an enormous sense of freedom, I tell my students, because I know in some jobs that people have, they don't have the freedom to speak the truth. And being a poet gives me that freedom, which I try to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. Also, Thich Nhat Hanh was an influence on me, and he mentioned the importance of not looking away from suffering. And so I like to remember that, too.
I'm curious because I know that you work for Greenpeace, and I want you to talk about the oil incident, as I'll call it, in a few minutes here, that got you more involved and brought you to quite a conclusion in your life. But
in terms of the oil incident, I was one of about 30 captains in Depot Bay charter fishing, and some of the captains were really excited because they thought that they were going to make money ferrying the oil men back and forth between the proposed rigs. So I did a bunch of research on it in the places where the oil companies had drilled, including the Gulf, and I found out that the whole thing was a big scam. Mm. That basically we had a beautiful sustainable resource off the Central Oregon coast that had been there thousands of years and would continue to be there. Most likely, and it was going to come under threat by this scam. So specifically, I found out that the oil spills under 1,000 gallons didn't have to be reported, and most of them weren't under 1,000 gallons. And some of these promises about hiring the local people to do the work fell through because they brought their own folks. So the Starting Horn restaurant is the restaurant that overlooks the bay, and the fishermen were gathered there while this oil man gave his presentation about how wonderful this was going to be. So I was about 26 years old, and I just challenged him publicly. Hmm. I was on my home turf. I was friends with those people. I'd known them for years. And at the time, I was much more aggressive than I am these days. I'm almost 50 years old now, so I've kind of mellowed out a little bit, but I kind of went after the throat, and I just tried to, as hard as I could, to embarrass him and yell at him and show him how he was wrong. And the result of that was that I persuaded the city council of Depot Bay and the fishermen of Depot Bay that we really didn't want to have these oil rigs. Wow. And so the city council allowed me to write the proposal against offshore oil drilling to the Oregon Governor's Ocean Resources Management Task Force on behalf of City Depot Bay. And also at the time, I was one of six charter boat operators representing the charter fishing interests along the 354-mile Oregon coast for the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association. So they were having meetings about this, and I raised as much hell as I could at the meetings. I got up and yelled, and I'm glad I did now, because when I look at what happened, you know, with the Gulf spill, and all the animals and so forth, I think, like I said, if I had to do over again, I would have tried to treat them like fellow human beings who were probably doing the best they could to understand, and I probably would have taken more of the Thich Nhat Hanh approach. But I do think that at the time, being that loud and that angry and that vengeful did get people's attention, and the letters that I wrote and the yelling that I did maybe had some small part in helping to stop that oil drilling off the Oregon coast. It was really a good thing that I took my time with my classes, because I got to enjoy all that time with the whales and the albatross and the salmon and all that. So I think one of the coolest things I just told my sister, my brother has a couple of young kids, is how they take these kids in the best years in their lives and they stick them in boxes for 12 years.
Yeah.
You know, well, you have the springs are blossoming and the quiet snows are falling in the winter, and, you know, just, I really think that's a sad thing. I'm hoping that, you know, when they redo education, they make it more holistic and they get people outside where, I mean, there's so much you learn from direct experience that you just can't get from books, you know?
Sure, indeed. I want you to talk to me, because I've actually read this book, and when I looked at it, I had to sort of laugh to myself because I said it is a really incredible book. But I want you to talk to me about it, and then I want to talk a little bit about journalism as a result of this. But it's a book by William Stafford, and it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it for anybody listening. It's called A Glass Face in the Rain. I want you to tell me a little bit about how that influenced you.
Sure. As I approached the end of my undergraduate degree, I knew I had to do something with my life, and I was keenly aware that, like most people, I'd only be on the planet Earth about, you know, so about age 80 or 85. So at the end of the day, like, what's going to have meaning for me? So I'm in the tiny little library at Western Oregon University, and I'm pulling books off the shelf. Like, my dad had it in his mind that I was going to be a scientist, you know, so I pull off astronomy, no, chemistry, no, and then, so I'm pulling off all these books off the bookshelves thinking about what I want to do with my life, and then I pull off a guy, Glass Face in the Rain by William Stafford. And I read the book, and I decide that, you know, at the end of my life, looking back, it would have meaning if I devoted my life to this. He had found something that, to me, was really important, so I decided to devote my life to teaching poetry, writing poetry, and reading poetry, and so... Basically, that book, The Glass Face in the Rain, is what catapulted me into deciding to become a creative writing professor and all that. Thanks for asking about that. He's not the only one that influenced me. Like I said, I love Carolyn Forshay, too, and she seems sort of the opposite of Stafford. Stafford was always not too much pleased and not a real loud poet or... aggressive poet, and Forshay was very intense and politically wise, and I think they're both amazing poets. So sometimes when I'm talking to my students about it, I say the main thing is to be yourself. It sounds really easy, but it's so hard to be yourself and to be comfortable with that. And the video I use in class, William Stafford and Robert Bly, Literary Friendship, shows how they're very different. So there's something that is contagious where, like you're saying, you get people up there that are being themselves, and it kind of prompts you to be honest, you know, with what you're reading.
Yes.
Too. It's contagious. It's really a great thing how that happens.
As a teacher, what is sort of what you see in this next generation? I know they have such almost what seems like insurmountable obstacles finding jobs in a very bad economy, etc., etc. What do you see in them maybe that's positive? Because I know some of them are much more active and much more involved in, say, in environmental politics than my generation was. And also, what do you see, well, positive and negative, what do you see as positive and negative in the current generation that you're teaching?
I've been teaching for 20 years now, and I have noticed some changes. Like, some things sort of stay the same. Like, now I have Iraq vets with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I used to have Vietnam vets.
Wow.
But in terms of, like, the people, yeah, the good and the bad. I remember teaching Eliot, and he had this idea of the objective correlative, where you try to evoke, like, an emotion from somebody, but then I tell the students that Jack Kerouac said that was so much constipation. He said, what it's really about is the human urge to freely sing.
Yes.
And in terms of what's holding people back, like, I have a creative writing class this term. Maybe some of my students will listen to this. It's really a great class.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think they would admit, many of them, that there's just too much fear in the room.
Huh.
And I think the problem is that that human urge to freely sing gets stifled by the tremendous fear to the point where many of them won't send their work out to editors and journals because they're afraid of rejection. So I try to tell them, you know, William Stafford said you have to be careless about failure. He said you have to be willingly fallible to deserve a place in the realm where miracles happen. So there's a huge amount of fear holding people back. And, you know, I teach at community colleges mostly. Like right now, I teach at San Diego Mesa College. And so these students, in many cases, have jobs and they have families and they're trying to survive and they're worried about what's going to happen to them. There's always a tension between the need to make a buck and the need to do what you want to for a living. And
yeah.
I try to tell them if you can do both, you know, that would be really great. You know, when basically Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss, and where you thought there were no doors, doors will open into palaces, he said. And at the same time, if you have some skill, then you can pay the rent too. In terms of what I see, what I've noticed recently is the students are very much into technology.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't have a cell phone. not 100% true. I have a cell phone in my fishing krill, which I never use in case I get attacked by a mountain lion or something. I mean, I was fishing in the gorgeous winter and carrying a 16-pound steelhead up the snow, and I saw the mountain lion tracks behind me that were following me the next morning. But other than that, you know, I don't have a cell phone, so I don't want a cell phone. They, you know, sometimes they text message in the back of the room, so they're very much into technology. And I was talking with them a couple weeks ago about Facebook, and some of the students said, yeah, it's good because you can stay connected to your friends and family from great distances, but it's also kind of sad how sometimes young people burn up, you know, all day long, you know, on Facebook, and there's a whole world out there. And so, you know, it's a tool like anything that can be used for good or bad, but I remember when Robert Bly went to the classroom where I was a student, Tom Ferte, who died a few years ago, was one of my favorite teachers, and he was the professor at the time, and one of the students in class asked if Robert Bly would be his mentor, and Robert Bly's answer was at the time, and we're talking now 1986 or 87, so I probably can't get exactly, but I'll do my best. Bly said that basically I have this cabin way out in the woods, and you have to spend all winter there, and if I see any tracks in the snow coming in or out, the deal is off.
Wow.
And the reason behind that, I think, I mean, he could speak for himself if he ever talks about it, but was that there's a need to spend alone time. Like, I go back home to Oregon every 3 weeks, and I'm out by myself in the wilderness of Southwest Washington and Oregon, and I really need that to come back and teach, you know. So many tribes in the Northwest Coast, you know, had this idea of going out to seek a spirit helper, where I think many young people in our society don't have the same initiation opportunities.
Yeah.
I mean, I went on Outward Bound when I was, like, young, and so I spent, you know, the 3 days fasting and got to really appreciate, you know, things I had in my family and met amazing people. It was only, I think, like 28 days or something. But I think the alone time is really, really important to cut off the, like, when I decided I wanted to be a writer,
yeah,
I gave up television. I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
So now here I am, I'm like 48 years old. I haven't watched television since I was 15.
Wow.
Unless I was at a friend's house or hotel or something, and
sure,
that's given me time to spend on you know, writing and reading and these kinds of things. So but I wish I had a better answer for you. I'm thinking about, you know, where they're going. I mean, I get many young people that haven't lived long enough to really know what they're up against, and so I don't want to tell them. Instead what I'd say is, you know, vitality will push you through barriers that
sure,
you can't predict what a flame's going to become, but if you squelch it, it won't become anything.
Yeah.
I don't tell them that if they want to be creative writing professors, they may have to compete against, you know, 100 to 200 people for one job, mostly overqualified people.
Yes.
Unless I do get some people that want to pursue that as a career, and I'm brutally honest with them, but most of my job, and the reason I like William Stafford so much, is to try to inspire people to go for what they really want before they put the limitations on themselves. Anyway, I guess I should give you a chance to talk, because maybe I'm getting kind of off the track.
No, it's a good answer. It's I read a study or heard of a study recently that said something like 90% of the current population, I guess every generation, I imagine, that's sort of, as I like to say, plugged in, which means cell phones, computers, etc., prefer to use text messages, really do not like talking on the phone, and would much rather email than go visit their friends, say, in Oregon. So we've become sort of disengaged from people, from each other in that way. I think that that's the bummer of technology, so I would agree with you. But it's also given us things that we didn't have, you know, 20 years ago when you were teaching. It's easier to get the word out, in a sense, about what you want to speak about. So there is a positive. But, yeah, it's quite sad, some of the things that are happening. But, you know, that's just me as the cynic talking. I'll let you read. So if you want to choose, say, 5 poems, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay. William Stafford said, you know, things come toward you when you walk. And there's this Buddhist idea that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, meaning there's like an implicit trust in the universe to bring things up. When I worked at Greenpeace, I lived in a big house with like 5 guys, and one of the guys was like my brother, Eric. And basically he would say to me, why do you want to go watch whales when you could put a tape in the VCR, Scott?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, Eric, like, and I loved him dearly. He died of a heart attack, and I'll read a poem about that in a few minutes. But basically I said, Eric, you know, you're on the ocean. The saltwater spray is in your face. You have these colored puffins. The whales are moving. They come up underneath the hull of the boat, and then they go from to one side or the other. They won't hit you. The whales don't bother people unless they're attacked, you know, unless they're speared, you know. So basically, I was trying to get that world across to him, but there's just no substitute for the real thing. I heard one professor say that equations can't get off the chalkboard fly like a bird can. But anyway, Eric was really an important influence on me. And he was like a brother to me, and so I will find that poem. And it's one of the poems that's up, Fog Clarity. So I'll try to dig through and find that one here. Eric was gay, and I was straight, and so I went to his house for Christmas dinner and saw what that was about and how hard it was for him to be I don't want to say the wrong word here, so that's why I'm slowing way down. But it was really hard for him to be a young gay man growing up, both in his family and in society.
Yeah.
And I have many young gay writers in my classes, and basically, Eric had a huge impression on me, so I will read this poem. Eric said he's amazed at what lizards teach us. Blend in when you can. Move at night to hide from birds of prey, and run like hell when kids show up with peanut butter jars. He said his father nearly disowned him for being gay, but he tried to awaken with a song in his heart and know there's nothing wrong with that. Eric told me, a straight Roman Catholic, if you want a miracle, look at a cricket. And the secret of the universe is hidden in the beagle. When I looked perplexed, he added, Darwin's boat, you idiot. The day a heart attack killed him, I, on a drive to Eastern Oregon, cried all the way up the Columbia. And then I think it's really important to try to balance oneself. I know there's the Israeli poet Amici, and he talks about poems being like many, many small steps that a person takes to keep from falling down. And so I want to be clear, I don't just write serious poems. I try to write, you know, lighthearted, laughing poems too, because that's part of the human experience. And maybe for balance I should read some of those.
Sure.
So. Or at least one of them. This one's called At the Trout Stream in Merrimack Spring, Missouri, and it came from a true story. When I taught for 2 years at Lakeland College in Mattoon, Illinois, I was really hungry for trout fishing, so I drove down to Missouri to do some of that, and I was kind of stunned about what happened, but I guess I should read the poem. At the Trout Stream in Merrimack Spring, Missouri, a man displays a green pellet fly that matches pellets in the trout food machine. He opens his aluminum fly box of darker and lighter pellet variations. Thinking of the Deschutes River, I tell him I am from Oregon, where, on wild rivers, we don't have trout food machines yet. When he offers a quarter for bait, I say, you used to live underwater in your mother. You were a moonfish because your origin followed the cycle of the moon. You heard gentle underwater sounds. You wiggled like a fish. You were a sea mammal. You were the whale of your world. Okay, he says, 2 quarters. And I don't know if I have other funny poems here. I guess I don't right now. I guess I do, if I dig deep enough. I was fishing on Upper Eagle Creek. That comes up near the top of Clackamas River, and we kind of got lost and wrote this poem while I was lost, if I can find it here.
Sure.
Oh, here it is. This is a warrior poem. Warrior says the problem when following deer trails when lost is they almost never take you to Burger King. They can go straight uphill and straight down. Deer also like circles, figure eights, and spirals. They don't care if you get home by 5 or February. This one isn't funny, but it's sort of uplifting, so I've been talking about so many serious issues, I guess I should try to read this one. This is called Ordinary Grass on Cascade Head. Cascade Head is really important to me because I fished off there for 8 years.
Yeah.
with the Starfisher, and then I was a writer in residence there too, at the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology. So, I saw it from the ocean side and also from the inner. So this one's called Ordinary Grass on Cascade Head. Is extraordinary when one considers pre-earth emptiness followed by wood flute music, stone carvings, watercolor meadows, shell and bone sculptures. Closer, a child lifts a hand-drawn rainbow shirt over a branch. Elk lounge in a grove. Masks and talus and spruce gradually rise in evening shadows as dream time bridges to here and now. Deep breaths welcome me back. In an A-frame cabin, someone is cooking curry. A thought sprouts like a golden chanterelle. Whatever they offer you to live away from here is not enough. So that's probably all the material I want to read from that book.
Very nice. I have two final questions for you. One that is important to me is because you have another art. You also work with clay. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that and also where people can find your art in clay, where they can go look.
Okay, I'll start with the last part. I was really happy that the Spirit of the Salmon Fund for the Columbia River Tribes took two of my clay pieces and sold them. And if somebody goes to the, they can just Google Spirit of the Salmon Fund, art gala, and see my work there. Also, I have work at Columbia River Gallery in Troutdale, but they took some of that down. Recently, my work has appeared at the Trumpeter Journal of Ecosophy at Athabasca University. They published my essay, Wild Salmon,
yeah.
And they took three pieces of my art. And then also Untitled Country Review in Portland, Scott Siegel took, I think, three pieces or four pieces of my art at the issue before this one. So if people go to any of those places, they could see the artwork.
Great. You have a blog, don't you, where people can also go and sort of see what's going on with you?
I don't have a blog. I noticed that poets and writers allow customization of the websites they offer for free.
Yeah.
So I'm using that. I just
okay.
go there about once or twice a year and just go to my poets and writers website and I just sort of add things to it. Maybe I'll put this interview up there. That would be good.
I mean, it's a good place for people to have a basis to sort of do a little bit more research and some of the bigger words that we've used that they're not going to have a clue unless they actually can look at it in text. It kind of makes a difference. You know what I mean?
Right, I probably should do a blog at some point.
I won't hold you to it, my friend, but you know, I'm just asking.
So a website at least, but I'm pretty approachable though. I mean, people could, you know, fire me off an email to my address that's on that, you know, Poets and Writers website, and
okay.
I'm usually pretty good at getting back to folks. I do have one more poem to read.
Yeah, sure.
So I guess this would probably be the last one. When I lived in Tigard, Oregon, there was like an old growth forest behind my house, and there was a creek down the end of the street. And what happened is, maybe I'll read two poems about this. What happened is that developers came in, and they turned the creek into a pipe, and they took the old growth forest. I mean, I used to see salamanders back there, and owls, and pheasants, and made it into a housing development.
Nice.
And so that's one of the reasons I think I got into Greenpeace and got into the whole nature poem thing is because there was a sense of, like, having your best friend run over by a car or something. I mean,
yep.
It was a real sense of loss.
Yeah.
I saw the same sense of loss when I read David James Duncan's book, My Story is Told by Water, that was nominated for National Book Award. Mm-hmm. David James Duncan's one of my favorite writers, and basically he had this creek, and he came back one day, and it was gone. It's like the water wasn't there anymore. And I read that, and I go, yeah, I can relate to that completely. So let's see. Well, I may have to just read one poem about it.
No, that's fine. That's totally fine. Hey, before you read, let people know, and I want to reiterate so they have another idea where they can find your works. Of course, they can go to Heavy Bear, which is at janecrown.com, and they can check you out. You're in one of the last issues. I had a double issue, so just scope it out. It's up there. The current chap that he read from today is the Warrior Poems. His name is Scott T. Starbuck. That's with two T's. You can also find Riverwalker. Who did Riverwalker for you, Scott?
That one hasn't come out yet. It's Mountains and Rivers Press in Oregon, and they said that would come out like 2011 or 2012.
Okay, cool.
something like that.
Okay.
So, yeah, I really wish I could find this other one here, so I'm just digging for it, but I'm going to have to, maybe the universe doesn't want me to read that one. Maybe it wants me to read this one.
That's okay.
So I'll read this one. So this one's called The River That Flows Through Town, and it's that whole issue with a pipe.
Okay.
The river that flows through town is not imaginary, though only young explorers know it. In the tree line along the housing tract between concrete tubes, stick boat races, crawfish to be caught, raccoon tracks. To be there, you have to turn off the TV and go outside. You can keep your churches, your schools, your after-school programs. These hidden sections are the only real hope these kids have. I guess it kind of fits what we're talking about with technology,
yeah,
too, and all that. So
indeed.
I think it's a good one to end on, good note to end on.
Very nice. I want to remind people of something that a Chippewa woman once said to Theodore Roosevelt. She said, you know, you've cut down all the trees, you've overfished, you've overhunted, you've taken everything, so I sure the hell hope you can eat your money. So none of us do this for money. We do it for the love of what we appreciate. Yours is nature and obviously mankind. You're a terrific guest, man, and I love your work. I hope you'll still continue to submit to Heavy Bear. You've been terrific. Again, my guest today was Scott T. Starbuck, reading from the Warrior Poems and a couple other things today. Please check it out. Go to janecrown.com. This will be up in archives within the next 48 hours. So thank you for coming on, man. It's been my distinct pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Jane.
Okay, you take care now.
Bye-bye.